This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. This week we're finding out about 1066 and all that, a year that was pivotal for British and Irish history, and we'll debate how the Norman conquest reshaped power across England, Wales, Scotland and Ireland. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. And also a reminder that to listen to any of your favourite News Talk content, just go to the Go Loud app. The Norman conquest was perhaps the most transformative event in English history, and it changed entirely the course of the second millennium. It was a sustained and often brutal conquest and was met with determined resistance from English nobles and local leaders. William of Normandy secured victory at the Battle of Hastings through force and calculated alliances, and in tonight's show we want to find out why the Norman invasion succeeded and how it helped shape the world that followed. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Judith Green is Emeritus Professor at the University of Edinburgh, a leading expert on the histories of England and Normandy between the 10th and 13th centuries. She's the author of The Normans, as well as The Aristocracy of Norman England, and she's currently working on a book on William Rufus. Professor Claire Downham is Professor of Medieval History at the University of Liverpool and is an expert on Viking Age history and contact across the Irish Sea in the Middle Ages. And she's the author of Medieval Ireland, AD 400 to 1500. Professor Sean Duffy is Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at Trinity College Dublin, and he's a leading expert on medieval Ireland and Irish relations with England, Scotland and Wales in this period. And joining us for the first part of the show, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Tom Lysons, Professor of Medieval History and Literature at the University of East Anglia, and he's a leading expert on the Norman conquest, and his books include studies of Edward the Confessor and Harald II. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be joined by Professor David Bates, Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at the University of East Anglia. He's a leading expert on the Normans, and he's the author of William the Conqueror and The Normans and Empire. Well, as I say, you're all very welcome. And Sean, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a controversy that erupted last year in this country when there was a discussion about the Normans and commemorating the Normans. And some people, including politicians in Sinn Féin, got very upset about this.
Yes. I mean, what happened here, Patrick, is that 2027, we think, is the millennium of the birth of William the Conqueror. I mean, historians fight about that as well. The government of Normandy decided that this was an occasion when they might do something to mark that event, because he is a major historical figure by any reckoning. And they reached out, as they say nowadays, to the governments in the different regions which were affected by the Normans in England, Scotland, Wales, Ireland, Sicily, Flanders and elsewhere. And they asked them, might they be willing to take part in events to mark the millennium, to commemorate the millennium, not necessarily to celebrate the birth of William the Conqueror, but to mark it in some way so that we could all learn from the process. And our government responded very positively to that. And, you know, it said that they would engage with it and they would partake in such events. It did obviously cause a ruffle a few feathers in Ireland because, William the Conqueror was the ancestor of the people who conquered Ireland in the late 1160s. And Angus O'Snoddy, for example, Sinn Féin spokesman on these affairs, has stated that we should not be celebrating them. To celebrate them is akin to celebrating Cromwell in Ireland. But, you know, I don't think, I mean, I'm a historian. It's not about celebrating. We had a wonderful, we should be very proud of what we did in this country over the last decade, in the decade of centenaries, when we had to mark the centenary of delicate events like Ireland's role in the First World War, the 1916 Rising, the War of Independence, the Civil War. And we rose to the occasion because we used it as an opportunity to learn and to study the past and to have respect for the past. And that is all that's proposed here. So I don't think that it's anything to be worried about. I think it's something we should embrace because it is, we are one of those regions of Europe that was heavily affected by the Normans, and we need to learn more about it.
So, Judith, what about how the Normans are viewed in Britain then? How are they considered? Because it seems like over the past 1,000 years, there's been so many myths and legends, and then there's also been so much kind of rewriting of the story, sometimes portraying them as heroes and romanticising it in novels and in other stories, and then sometimes seeing them as the villains of the piece.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that as far as I can see, there's fairly tepid interest in 1027 at the moment because world events are so dramatic. I think that in the past, when I was, as it were, a schoolgirl, it was very much 1066 and all that. And the idea that the Normans came in as innovators, driving England to a glorious imperial future. And of course, all that's gone. But what you still have is the memory of 1066 as the one date in English history, which everybody knows. And the Bayeux Tapestry can be put into newspaper cartoons without any explanation. People recognize these figures. So we've come a long way. And as you say, each generation has reinvented what it thinks about the Normans. But it isn't, as it were, a live topic in the way that is so sensitive in Ireland today.
And 1066 and all of that, you know, the fact that this is the 960th anniversary of the Battle of Hastings. Why is the Battle of Hastings such an iconic date? Why is that such an iconic event or seen as such an iconic event? Because it is seen as transformational in terms of English history. And I wonder, Judith, was it?
Yes, it was. I think I spent some years writing a book arguing that we shouldn't divide English history into periods by 1066. But there's no doubt that it's not just the change of a ruling dynasty, but it's the sweeping away of a whole aristocracy and an insertion of top people in the church as well as the state, a complete transformation, rebuilding all the major churches, profound impact on law, and people like peasants and women at the bottom of the scale, largely unrecorded, were the victims of all of this. But undoubtedly, it transformed it. I think where I was arguing a few years ago is that what the Normans conquered was not the whole of medieval England, and it took time to conquer England north of the Humber and the Mersey. Northern England was still really bandit country as far as the Normans were concerned.
Tom, let's talk about the background then to the Battle of Hastings, because we have King Edward the Confessor, who dies without leaving a clear heir. And it then seems to kick off this whole Game of Thrones succession battle where you have various claimants to the throne.
Well, the old idea was that King Edward the Confessor died without leaving an heir, but I'd argue that he left an heir that everybody knew. His heir was Edgar Atheling, his great nephew and adopted son. And there were clues that Edward was lining up Edgar Atheling to be king after him. What then happened is that Harold took the throne and had himself crowned the very day that Edward died, and Edgar Etheling was pushed aside. And this set a precedent so that anyone else who fancied having a go at the throne and thought that they had a better claim than Harold, or perhaps could take it from him, then took their opportunity to get an army together and come and invade. And this is why 1066 is the last time England has been invaded by multiple foreign powers, all of them looking at the throne and thinking that it's theirs for the taking.
And there are these various invasions. And how come, why does William the Conqueror succeed where some of the others fail?
It's a complex question. Obviously, Harold's forces have been weakened by fighting against the great Norwegian leader, Harald Hardrada, in the north. So Harold's forces are depleted. And there are some indications that he's not at full strength at Hastings, where William confronts him head on. But it may be the case that William has a greater variety of troops. He's got not only foot soldiers, but cavalry, but archers. And he's able to use all of those in different combinations throughout the course of a long day's fighting, while Harold is pretty much stuck in a quite tight position on top of a hill. So I think William's got more sort of versatility in terms of the tactics he can use, and he may have had a larger force.
And Harold does win a significant victory at the Battle of Stamford Bridge a few days before, but then, as you say, the force is weakened, they're more tired, and it seems that the Normans under William have better tactics. They're able to kind of, one thing I read suggests that they pretended that they were in panic and retreating, and then they were when Harold's forces abandoned their defensive positions, they were able to be outflanked.
Yes, there's a well-known tactic called the feigned flight. That is a group of cavalrymen who've trained together feigning retreat in order to lure their opponents down to chase after them. And then wheeling around all of a sudden and sort of cutting down those infantry who run down from the hill. And this seems to be used at the Battle of Hastings possibly twice, certainly once. This sort of warfare, William's men are very, very skilled in this sort of thing. So it's a trick they pull off. Possibly because the English on the hilltop have suffered a loss of leadership at that point. I think Harold himself would have known about this and would have steadied the ranks, but it may be that the message wasn't getting across to all of his men for one reason or another. And of course, if you're standing on top of a hill defending your position all day long from repeated attacks by the enemy, your morale and resolve begins to break down. And you're vulnerable, perhaps, to being lured into these sorts of traps. So I think, yes, William was a very, very cunning warrior and general.
So, Claire, where does Ireland fit into this then? Because as Sean has mentioned, it's in the following century where you see the Normans coming to Ireland. But there are important connections even in this period.
Yes, so definitely. So there's always been quite a lot of trade across the Irish Sea region. And what we find in the years before 1066 is sometimes there are political refugees or people who've fallen foul of the authorities who flee to Dublin or flee to Ireland. So we have a couple of examples of that during the reign of Edward the Confessor. It's kind of interesting as well. We've actually got an account by a Danish writer, Adam of Bremen, who says that in 1066, Harald Hardrada's invasion, which came to Northumbria, had Irish and Scottish support. Now, we don't know what underpins that, but it's a really tantalising claim. And also we know that after the Battle of Hastings, two of Harold Godwinson's sons, so two sons of the last English king, fled to Ireland and then tried to use Ireland as a base for attempted invasions to regain control of England. So clearly, Irish Sea politics at this time was hugely important. But of course, we tend to undervalue its significance because those attempts by the sons of Harold to regain power in England failed.
So, Tom, let's go back then to the story of the invasion and the story of this incredible conflict then, where you have competing forces vying for the crown. How much was the country caught up in this? And was there any sense of what direction it was going to go in, or even who was going to be victorious?
Well, pretty much all of the country is involved at some stage. So you have men of the northern shires fighting against Harald Hardrada in the early phases of the warfare of 1066, and then men of the southern shires and Midlands and East Anglia fighting against William's forces. So pretty much all sides of the country, all parts of the country are affected by these invasions. And there are some indications that not everyone's showing up for Harold. There's a clue, for example, that Robert FitzWymark, who's who's a leading man at court and Sheriff of Essex, he goes over to William's side and is secretly working for William. And one or two other leading men might not have turned out. There were lots of complaints after 1066, but not everyone had showed up. You know, you've got the blame game going on, the blame shifting. And I think if there had been such a thing as the Hastings inquiry, it would have shown some interesting gaps in Harold's army. So it's not at all clear who's going to win this complex conflict. The only thing I'd say is that no Duke of Normandy had ever managed to mount an invasion of England before, to get together a fleet and achieve anything on that front, although one or two had tried. And so what William pulled off really was quite a remarkable feat, and perhaps not something anyone could have seen coming.
And Tom, do you think William had a legitimate claim, or what was his claim to the throne?
William had a track record of bullying his way into principalities where he saw an opening. I think if he saw any sort of open door, he'd get his foot in it and push as hard as he could. He did this with Maine in 1063 and with Brittany in 1065. And what he saw in 1066 with England was a country that was still divided after a northern rebellion, where the new king had big questions around his legitimacy, where the new king's own brother Tosti had gone into exile and was now gathering forces against him. So he saw really something he could prey upon. And I suspect that a lot of his arguments about having been offered the throne by Edward the Confessor were made up as justification for an opportunistic strike.
And, you know, without drawing parallels with events in the world today, you do see a sense there that when people feel that might is right and that they have the power to intervene and to act and to strike, they think that it does give them the legitimacy then to make whatever claim or demand they want.
Well, particularly when someone's already set that precedent. So as soon as Harold decided that he was the best man to be king and had his supporters around him, he was already laying down a new set of rules for the game, that the person who's able to seize the throne can have the throne. And you see the same thing in ancient Rome with the year of the three emperors, AD 68 to 69, where the legitimate sort of established dynasty dies out with the death of Nero. And then really there's a question mark as to who can take over, because there's no rightful heir. And so every general who's got an army piles in, and you have these three emperors in quick succession. And I see 1066 as a bit like that. You know, the legitimate line dies out or is usurped by Harold, and that really gives license to anybody else looking around to think, oh, well, I can come and do the same, might is right.
And Judith, when we look at the Normans, are we talking about soldiers of fortune? Are we talking about, you know, warriors or a kind of a standing army? What exactly was this force?
It was composed, the dominant members were William's close kin, and they were senior people who had fought alongside him because he'd had decades of fighting his way to the top because of his birth, establishing himself there. He's the leader, essentially, of this important section of the Norman aristocracy, and they need to be kept rewarded. And I think that I absolutely agree with everything Thomas said about William seeing the door open and thinking, right, I'm going to go for it. And he persuades these seasoned warriors who have warriors of their own to invest in this expedition. But also he has to do it, because if the momentum which had driven him to the top in Normandy would begin to falter, as indeed it did later in his life.
And Judith, we are talking about not just one battle. It's a whole series of battles then. It's a sustained conquest where you do see various forms of resistance, and this is an ongoing struggle for them.
It is, and we tend to forget that. Hastings is one of the few decisive battles in medieval Europe, but it was followed up. William obviously thought it was all okay. He got crowned, and that was a crucial step in establishing his own legitimacy. Then he goes back to Normandy and things begin to unravel. And he comes back, and it's a combination of his personal leadership, being able to use this inner core of commanders who are soon calling on English forces to reinforce their own war bands. And he goes through the southwest, the Midlands, and he builds castles and he starts handing out lands. So he's cutting the ground away from under the feet of the two great earls who had been prepared to submit to him, Edwin and Morcar. He gets as far as York and he holds that with difficulty, has to go back. Further north, things get more and more tricky, and he resorts to great harrying of the north in the winter of 1069 to 70, after which there is less sustained rebellion. But as Tom was saying, the fact that there was no national resistance against William the Conqueror, and the fact that some of the English were soon prepared to fight in his armies and do deals with the Normans, is part of the secret of his success. But it was a remarkable story.
A remarkable story indeed. And Sean, where does Scotland and Wales and indeed Ireland fit into this remarkable story? What did the Norman conquest of England mean for them?
Yeah, it's a very extraordinary fact, Patrick, which I've never really been able to get my head around how easily and how quickly the Normans conquered England. You know, within the space of about 5 years, everything had more or less died down. And I've never had a satisfactory explanation from English historians of that. But the Normans, not being respecters of borders, within a couple of years, they were starting to seep into Wales. Within a decade and a half, they had moved as far west as Anglesey and established a temporary presence there until they were subsequently ousted from it. And by the early 1090s, they had got as far as the Pembrokeshire area of southwest Wales. And they established a presence there, which became a permanent presence. And of course, literally within sight of Ireland there. So I suppose, in a sense, Ireland was on the horizon from that moment onwards. Large parts of native Wales were conquered. So you had the establishment of this thing called the Welsh Marches, the March of Wales, which is kind of a border country that wasn't quite in Wales any longer, but yet still wasn't in England. And William established these border earldoms there, the Marcher Earls, to try to defend that frontier. The same was true with Scotland. Now, Scotland was somewhat different from the Welsh situation because the borders of, like, what was Scotland in the 11th century? It was still a very fluctuating thing. And the border that we think of between England and Scotland, the established border at the Tweed to the Solway, that wasn't recognised in the 11th century. And for a good deal longer. So where that border might end up was a matter of contention, and that therefore led to these disputes. So somewhere like Newcastle on Tyne, which is on the River Tyne, that was established in the decades immediately after. That's a new castle because it was a new Norman castle that was established there by the Normans to try to consolidate their movement north in the late 11th century. But the decades, indeed the centuries of conflict between England and Wales have largely been a consequence of that kind of messy outcome of the Norman conquest of England. Because as far as William and his descendants were concerned, it wasn't England they conquered. It was this archipelago that they had a claim to. I mean, to say that the rest is history, I mean, Judith was talking about how it's important that we don't use 1066 as a kind of a be-all and end-all date. You know, a lot of the things that we assume were a consequence of post-1066 had started to occur prior to that. So it mightn't have been so fundamental. But it is the case that relations between Ireland and England, for instance, had been, relatively speaking, apart from one or two awkward moments, relatively peaceful for centuries. But after 1066, we were on a downward path towards difficulties. And those, obviously, in the 12th century, when the descendants of William came to Ireland and conquered Ireland, and we became England's first overseas colony. I mean, 1066 ultimately proved, therefore, incredibly transformative and traumatic for Ireland.
Then we'll explore that a little bit as well, and in fact, why it took that 100 years for that follow-up into Ireland. Tom, if Harold had won the Battle of Hastings, would that victory have secured him on the throne, or would there have been other invasions or other attacks or other battles that he would have had to have fought? Or would this have been transformational for England and indeed for Europe?
Well, there are always a lot of variables when we try to predict what might have happened had events turned out differently. But I think if William the Conqueror had died at the Battle of Hastings and obviously not earned himself a nickname the Conqueror, things would have been very different because there wouldn't have been anybody else really in a position to mount an invasion. And Harold's, what would have been his twin victories then against Harold Hardrada in the north and William of Normandy in the south would have cemented his reputation as probably the most successful warrior king in English history since Alfred, and I think probably more so than Alfred. So I doubt anybody would have taken him on, and he would have been fairly secure on the throne and might easily have reigned another 20 years or so.
And what was the level of resistance to the Normans? You know, was it, I know things weren't settled after 1066, but it certainly wasn't as turbulent as one might have expected.
The most dangerous points for the Normans in the 4 or 5 years after 1066, and I think as someone's already pointed out, it took that time for them really to get a grip on the country. It's quite a rapid takeover, really. But the most dangerous points are where you find alliances of people within the country, rebels, and foreign powers. So in 1069, for example, you've got rebels within England allying with the King of the Danes, Svein Estrithson, who had been a friend of Harold. And that poses a real threat to William, because he has to coordinate defences both against those within the realm and those outside. And there's also Edgar Atheling. He's still floating around, pressing his claim to the throne. He had briefly been proclaimed king after Harold's death in the interval between the Battle of Hastings and William being crowned at Christmas in 1066. So Edgar Atheling, in the eyes of many in England, is the rightful king. And he is a front man and figurehead for these alliances that sometimes coalesce around him. As I said, 1069 is a particularly dangerous point. But mostly the opposition William faces is small-scale, it's sporadic, it's uncoordinated. And in 1075, when there's a rebellion of three earls in England, he simply leaves his archbishop to deal with it and doesn't even return to do anything himself from Normandy. So he's able to travel safely between England and Normandy for those first few years and leave a lot of the quashing of England in the hands of his deputies.
Well, tonight we are talking about the Battle of Hastings, 1066, and indeed the Norman conquest of England. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be finding out about what the conquest meant for England, what it meant for Ireland, and what it meant for wider affairs. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about 1066. I'm delighted to be rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Judith Green, Emeritus Professor at the University of Edinburgh, who's a leading expert on the histories of England and Normandy between the 10th and 13th centuries, and her books include The Normans, as well as The Aristocracy of Norman England, Professor Claire Downham, Professor of Medieval History at the University of Liverpool, and a leading expert on Viking Age history, whose books include Medieval Ireland, AD 400 to 1500, and Professor Sean Duffy, who's Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at Trinity College Dublin and a leading expert on medieval Ireland and indeed Irish relations with England, Scotland and Wales. And we're also delighted to be joined now by Professor David Bates, who's Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at the University of East Anglia, and he's a leading expert on the Normans and whose books include William the Conqueror and The Normans and Empire. Judith, can we talk maybe about perceptions of the invasion? Because it seems to me, in the way the story of the Normans and the Norman conquest is told and retold, that there is a kind of a tension between whether this is the story of a brave people conquered by a foreign force, or whether this was really maybe something that led to a necessary, if painful, hybrid development in terms of the English national story, and that it wasn't a permanent wound, but something that was a stage in the development of the country, that in a way, some of the stories don't want to really deal with it as a conquest and then try and recast it as something that's more part of the story of England developing as a nation.
Yes, you're quite right. Certainly in the immediate aftermath of the conquest, as Tom was saying, the history is written mainly by the winners. And even the chroniclers who were English or half English by descent had to come to terms with the fact that the Normans weren't going away. And if they wanted promotion in the church, they had to write something that was favourable to the ruling regime. So you do get this sense of coming to terms with something they didn't like. Particularly churchmen felt that if you were English, you were just going to get sidelined as far as promotion was concerned. But over time, yes, it is seen as part of the developing story of the unification of the country, the rise of common law, which was, you know, the English system of law. England became much more dominant in the British Isles, as we've heard. So Normans could go and beat up the Welsh. and press into that middle area, which we think of as Rory Stewart has called Middle Land, between England and Scotland, and press north. So, yes, that affects the way that the Normans were perceived as damaging but necessary, if you like.
So, David, talk to us then about William the Conqueror, because you've written this brilliant study of William and how and why he was so trusted by people to succeed with this invasion. And I wonder, what kind of a leader was he? What was he like in terms of being a military leader and a conqueror? And to what extent he was also a very good political leader in the way he was able to bring these alliances together, the way he was able to do these deals afterwards, and how he was able to secure victory through, I suppose, a mixture of force and calculated alliances?
Yes, it's a very, very good question. And in the end, what strikes me about William is, well, first of all, he never lost any, or he's never defeated in any military engagement until 1076. He has, in other words, over a very, very long period, a formidable military record. It's impossible not to mention the one thigh bone which survives from the tomb in the Abbey of Saint-Étienne of Caen, which shows that he was a very large and physically strong man. And what is so striking is that everyone talks about conquest as the Norman conquest, but actually in 1066, William brings together Breton, people from Brittany, Flanders, what we now call Picardy, to an extent Aquitaine. So, there's a dominance about the man, which you can see in a dominance, but also a capacity to impose himself in so many situations.
And in terms of his own character, he does seem to have a particular, there's a ruthlessness there, but then there's also a calculation. And it does seem to be able to build an alliance that succeeds where others who were involved in attempts to secure the throne, where they failed.
Well, yes. Although in the end, there's good fortune involved in all of this, because of course Harold in 1066 had made extensive preparations, fleets in the Channel, and so on and so forth. But then Harold Hardrada invaded from the north, so everything Harold had to go north. So to an extent, he was lucky, we might think, or at least fortune favoured him. I would also say that in some ways England, or the rulers of England, were not prepared, that well prepared for the crisis that everyone knew was going to come. So, there's an extent of good fortune, but in the end, the phrase which always comes back to me when I think about William and 1060 and what follows, well, two things come back to me. One is, first of all, this statement in William of Poitiers that foreign knights, i.e. non-Norman knights, came to William and joined William, confident in the justice of his cause, of course, but of course also that they would be well rewarded. And you have a sense, in other words, of a man who knew both to control and to reward. And the result, I mean, and it's happening almost from the beginning, the result is the replacement of the English elite, above all the secular and to a large extent the religious elites, in a quite extraordinary takeover. There's a wonderful, a very illustrative statistic. I mean, Chris Wickham says that this was the most ruthless takeover of another state and the destruction of our aristocracy before 1917.
And the incredible vast royal survey then that's conducted in the decades ahead, which becomes the Doomsday Book, that is a way of allowing William to tax, to govern, to control. It's a remarkable instrument of power to completely reshape what is happening in the country.
Well, yes. Doomsday looks back to the past, in that, of course, there's this wonderful phrase, in the time of King Edward, which is an adjustment from on the day on which King Edward was alive and dead. It actually puts landholding on a legitimate framework. It means that government, sorry, which is a somewhat an anachronistic term, but government is extraordinarily well informed about the resources of the kingdom. But on the other hand, it also gives everyone a framework within which to negotiate and to discuss. And I listened to Judith Green talking about the necessity of coming to terms with it. But let's then remember that in relation to Doomsday Book, the juries that gave evidence to the commissioners who came round were half English and half, well, French, so we say. So it was an extraordinary, you know, not entirely original, but an extraordinary way of almost consolidating what had happened over the previous 20 years. It was in more interest and more people's interest than Williams to have it done.
Claire, if we step back from England and look at 1066 from the Irish Sea world, how different does the story appear?
Well, I think obviously we tend to look back to 1066 and see it as the starting gun that eventually leads to the invasion and conquest of Ireland. And of course, for people living at the time, that would have been much less obvious. And Ireland had been a place where political rebels could flee to. We see that in the 11th century before 1066, and we see that happening at 1066. So we've got a couple of records of these sons of Harold Godwinson who flee to Ireland. So in 1068, Godwin, son of Harold Godwinson, attempts to land a force at Bristol, but fails. And then a year later, according to the historian Orderic Vitalis, we have a fleet which goes from Ireland to Exeter, 60 ships led by two sons of Harold. But they're heavily defeated. Orderic Vitalis, the Anglo-Norman writer, tells us that only two boatloads made it back to Ireland. So I think for people on this side of the Irish Sea, as it were, in Ireland, they might not have seen how permanent this set of affairs in 1066 would be. They saw it perhaps as an opportunity to advance the interests of Irish kings who had a network of alliances, both with regional English leaders, but also in Wales as well. I mean, another intriguing follow-up to that is 1075. Svein Estridsson, who is King of Denmark, was planning an invasion of England. And there's a possibility there may have been some collusion with Ireland at that time as well. So in Roskilde Ford, there is a Viking ship, Skuldul of Two, which some listeners may be familiar with because that was recreated as the Sea Stallion of Glendalough, which was sailed to Dublin. So this is a Viking-style ship that was built out of Dublin area oak in the mid-11th century. But the interesting thing is that the dendrochronology, which gives us a very precise chronology, suggests that this boat was patched up in Ireland in 1075 and then it was sunk in Roskilde Ford. So it's quite tempting to kind of see that there was these activities kind of behind the scenes where potential opponents to William the Conqueror's invasion of England were communicating with each other with the idea that this might be overthrown. But as I say, because those attempts came to nothing, we tend to just forget that they happened. But that wouldn't have been evident to people at the times that yes, as I say, William the Conqueror's power would become so permanently established.
And Claire, while all of this is happening and you do see that transformation and there's times when it seems to be going better than other times and it's not entirely clear what the end results will be, was there concern that this would have a big impact on Ireland? And was there a concern that, you know, maybe perhaps it wasn't 1066 wasn't determining Ireland's future, but it was perhaps narrowing the range of possibilities that for the future, that, you know, if all roads weren't leading to 1169, but perhaps it was making an invasion like that a possibility?
Yes, for sure. I mean, what we do see is it's not many years after William the Conqueror has settled his power in England, that there are hints at these imperial ambitions. It's interesting that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is an English source, but which continues on in some versions, says that if William the Conqueror had lived 2 years longer, that he would have conquered Ireland, and it says without any kind of display of force. So there was certainly this very bombastic rhetoric. And again, you know, we're living in a contemporary situation in the news at the moment where leaders say very ambitious things. You're not really sure, do they really mean it? Is this just words? Is this, you know, just claims? But we also have an ecclesiastical dimension to this as well. And this is quite intriguing because it shows the way that powers in England could exploit tensions within Ireland. So obviously Ireland at this time isn't unified. There are different kings. And so what we see is Lanfranc, who is the Archbishop of Canterbury under William the Conqueror, is involved in consecrating bishops of Dublin. And that's because bishops of Dublin at this time don't necessarily want to be under the dominion of an Irish archbishop. So they are happy to look abroad. And that then gives Lanfranc a foot in the door to claim some kind of ecclesiastical suzerainty over all of Ireland. So what we're seeing is, you know, within 10 years of sort of William the Conqueror making himself King of England, is that, you know, these lines of argument, these precedents are being set for the potential creep of English power extending across the Irish Sea. So I feel like, yes, the precedents are set, but we never quite know which direction it's going to go until, you know, the events of a century later.
Well, tonight on Talking History, we are talking about 1066. We're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll find out about the death of William the Conqueror and why it took 103 years after Hastings before the invasion of Ireland. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're Talking History, and tonight we are talking about 1066. David, let's talk about the death of William the Conqueror in 1087. And I'm interested in the way he divides his territories. His son Robert gets Normandy, and his son William Rufus, William the Red, he gets England.
Yes, Patrick, I'm going to divert you for a moment just to comment briefly on Claire's magnificent presentation. What strikes me is that there are Irish who think they can exploit the situation, just the same as in Scotland, David the First exploited the situation to his benefit. And it's almost as if, well, Dermot McMorrow, to cite an obvious case, the imperial power as offering benefit. Now, I, in the end, am inclined to think of the deathbed bequest as almost as an emotional decision, but one also informed by William's commitment to rules. Robert, his eldest son, had been promised Normandy. However, William and Robert had quarrelled, and Robert was actually in exile when his father died and didn't come to his deathbed. So, in other words, William would probably have seen probably have decided that Robert could not be trusted with Normandy and England together. Another important factor, and this really needs to be said in terms of the whole subject, including the Irish dimensions. William, as I calculate it, spent between 74 and 76% of his time after 1066 in Normandy. It was Normandy that was the threatened area of his territories. So to guarantee the future, he may have decided England and Normandy should, he hoped, be ruled by brothers who would cooperate, which they didn't.
And Judith, you're currently working on a book on one of those brothers, William Rufus, William the Red, who becomes King William the Second, and he dies 13 years later in a hunting accident when he's hit by an arrow. And it's remarkable the level of myth and legend around William Rufus seems to even go beyond that of William the Conqueror and the Norman Conquest, because he's the subject of various lurid tales and debates and controversies, and about whether he was a good king or not, about his private life, about how he died. And he seems the perfect subject for an exploration of this phase of the Norman Conquest.
He is. And I'm interested to hear David talk about what the Conqueror was intending about the succession to England and Normandy, because obviously I've been thinking about a lot about this recently. And you could argue that the Conqueror, brilliant military leader as he was, could not get to grips successfully this question of the succession. He fell out with his eldest son. He was derisory about his eldest son. But he couldn't get past the fact that Normandy had been promised to Robert as the eldest. So on his deathbed, William Rufus is sent over to England with a letter to Lanfranc, which presumably expressed the Conqueror's wish that Rufus would succeed him. And Rufus makes all sorts of promises about he'll be a good king, he'll respect the laws and so on, and then did very little of the kind. His private life, Tom Lysence is the big expert on this. He was probably gay or bisexual. He drives the financial resources of England to the utmost to sustain his laws. He intervenes in Scottish affairs, in Welsh affairs. He says he's going to build a bridge to Ireland. So that, again, is back on the table. And he dies probably through an accident, but who knows? It could have been murder, because the principal beneficiary is his younger brother, Henry, who is also in the New Forest at the time, rides off to secure the treasure at Winchester, rides to London and gets himself crowned within days. So it's a very dramatic story.
It also, again, it's almost 1,000 years ago, but yet there are so many contemporary parallels and resonances in terms of power and the abuse or misuse of power, about force and dominance and what people demand or feel they can take, that it's very much a current story as well, or there's powerful lessons in it.
Yes, it's hard power. The Normans are all about hard power. Cultural soft power may have come from it. Accommodation, integration, these are themes that historians have taken up. But in essence, this is hard power. Wherever you look at the Normans in Europe, or even in the Near East, in Antioch, it is hard power.
Sean, the thing that surprises me then is that when this is this exercise in hard power and the pursuit of power, why it took 103 years after Hastings for them to come to Ireland, why wasn't there an earlier invasion?
Well, I suppose you could ask the same question about the Romans. Patrick, how did the Romans, they conquered the world but not Ireland? And it's because, you know, they never got around to it because it wasn't that important. And the same is obviously true of Ireland. I mean, one of the most assertive and imperialistic of William's descendants was his great-grandson, Henry II, Henry of Anjou, who came to the English throne in 1154 at the end of a bloody civil war. And I always think it's a very extraordinary fact that having settled to the kingdom, having become king, settled the kingdom, trying to calm the storm of the civil war, almost, you could say, the first thing that he did after he was crowned was to gather together all his magnates to Winchester and to hold a council. And we have two separate accounts, sources for this, that declare that it is the case. The sole purpose of this council was to consider the conquest of Ireland. And the Archbishop of Canterbury's secretary, John of Salisbury, was sent off to Rome to investigate, you know, in the papal archive, possible evidence that England might have had suzerainty over Ireland in the past, certainly the English Church over the Irish Church. And that is the mission that came away with from the only ever English Pope, Adrian IV, Cardinal Nicholas Breakspear, before he had been elected, the famous or infamous document that we call Laudabiliter. It's a papal letter authorizing Henry to invade Ireland, and for our own good. I mean, and of course, religion is always part of the story in the Middle Ages. The perception was that the Irish had fallen out, hadn't engaged fully with the reform that was taking place in the church at the time, and they needed to be conquered it to be properly civilized. But even Henry, having got that papal license to come to Ireland, in the same way that William the Conqueror had papal approval for his conquest in 1066, he did nothing about it immediately. So he got that letter in 1155, and it's 1166 before a dispossessed Irish king, of course this is the famous Dermot McMurrogh, King of Leinster, came knocking on his door and asked for his assistance. And then that became the pretext ultimately for their arrival into Ireland. So I don't doubt for a minute that the Anglo-Norman kings had Ireland on their to-do list. It's just that obviously Ireland was, culturally speaking, from their point of view, and for somebody like Henry II, who, you know, spent his life in the Loire Valley and enjoying the... and who's, for most of whose third of a century on the throne of England, didn't actually visit England or didn't live in England. He'd rather live in France. Ireland was something that he'd like to do. And I think, you know, we should not forget the fact that when he died in 1189, his obituarists, when they wrote their obits of him, what is the thing that they praise most about Henry II's achievement? It's that he managed to do what the Romans had never done. He managed to conquer Ireland. So I wouldn't underestimate its significance, but it was something that wasn't a number one priority.
David, you delivered the prestigious Ford Lectures in Oxford, and it led to the book, The Normans and Empire. And is that what we're seeing in this period and in the centuries afterwards, the development of an empire? Or is it more the accumulation of different territories? What is the new power structure that's being created?
Yeah, well, I like the word empire, but this is so relevant to what you do, Patrick. But empire with a not with a capital letter. It's an analytical phenomenon. And yes, I was left thinking that we have to think of post-1169 Irish experience as an aspect of a world in which a dominant power at the core exploits when it needs to the periphery. And in some ways, one could say that Henry II was not necessarily interested in the conquest of Ireland until he found people like Strongbow, the Lacys and so on, all of them starting to establish themselves there. In other words, he had to not just control the Irish, but also some of his own followers. And what is then very striking is how closely related the early years of Ireland, 1169 to 1204, are what a big part the general, well, imperial world, Normandy, England, etc., etc., players in it. William Marshall, Strongbow, etc., etc., are very active in Normandy. And my favourite of all of this is always to think about the Priory of Four in Westmeath. It's a priory of the Abbey of Saint-Torrent of Évreux, which, of course, is not in England. So, it becomes with empire, I was thinking of it, yes, as hard power, but there's also a soft power and a need to control one's own followers and subjects as well as those around the periphery.
And Claire, a final thought then, it also shows from our discussion that when we talk about 1066, we need to rethink it as a story that goes beyond England and has much wider ramifications.
Oh, yeah, certainly. You know, we tend to look at these English kings and think of their, you know, power base and interest being very much facing the continent and being linked to France. But there are kind of key points where Ireland becomes an area of concern, or it's they're seen as a potential threat to the authority of English kings. And it certainly at those times really moves up to the top of their agenda.
Well, that does bring us to the end of our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts for exploring 1066, the Norman Conquest, and much more besides. Professor Judith Green, Emeritus Professor at the University of Edinburgh, Professor Claire Dannan, Professor of Medieval History at the University of Liverpool, Professor David Bates, Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at the University of East Anglia, Professor Sean Duffy, Emeritus Professor of Medieval History at Trinity College Dublin, and we were also delighted to be joined by Professor Tom Lysons, Professor of Medieval History and Literature at the University of East Anglia. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We'll have more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.